I'm Peter Gilchrist, and I'm a food writer.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton, and I am a food historian.
We're on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We're going to be talking to historians, producers, and some all-round great Scots to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're jumping into an era that redefined the very notion of Scottish food.
Kicking off with a focus on a very special time of year.
It's a very Victorian Scottish Christmas. Prince's Street in Edinburgh is as thronged at midnight on Hogmanay as at noon on any weekday. Between 11 and 12, people make their way to the Tron Kirk, and while the watch night service goes on within, a lively swaying crowd awaits the clamour of bells, sirens and hooters that signify the birth of a new year. Hawkers with trays of fowl's faces and other carnivalalia do a roaring trade. Here and there, groups of young people, some in carnival hats, some in complete disguise and equipped with long feathers, blowouts, tambourines and bells, are dancing and singing and throwing coloured streamers riotously around. Barrows of oranges and the windows of fruit and sweet shops that have remained open all night make oases of colour and gaiety in the dark northern lights. Hip bottles are freely proffered. Have you ever been to the Edinburgh?
I actually haven't, you know. It's always struck me as a bit chaotic.
Yeah.
And sort of, I mean, for one thing, it's really expensive.
But this is it. When Hogmanay is behind a paywall.
Exactly.
It's not Hogmanay.
And that image that you've just conjured, which is from Florence Marion McNeill's Scott's Kitchen, is it?
It's from one of our other books. Volume 3
of the Silver Bow. Nice.
Halloween to Yule.
Oh, lovely. But what she's conjuring there very much sounds like a kind of street party or carnival almost that anyone could join in, and it didn't matter who you were. And yeah, it was just, yeah, kids to adults to whatever class of person you were. And it sounds lovely. Very much not like a paid street party now.
No. But I suppose we should start off this episode by exclaiming, we are talking about Hogmanay.
Happy Hogmanay!
Happy Hogmanay, everyone!
Happy New Year! Christmas is over. Christmas is past.
Yes.
We're looking forward to New Year's Eve.
I'm exhausted this year.
I am too. And I don't know if it's just because you and I have been doing so much more thinking about Christmas than perhaps normally. I had a lovely Christmas. It wasn't particularly busy, but yeah, tiring. I think as you get older, it sort of becomes more stressful.
Lindsay.
What?
As we enter our golden era.
The sun sets on.
I do think there is something maybe specific to food writers or food historians, where I have been making Christmas food since September.
Yeah.
And I have been writing about Christmas and Hogmanay since September.
Yeah.
And I kind of arrived at Christmas Eve with empty baggage.
A bit burnt out.
I'm actually over this. Yeah. I'm actually okay. What I have enjoyed actually was Boxing Day.
Oh, I love Boxing Day.
I think that's the secret sauce, where the expectations are over. Mm. And we've already been talking about for the last three episodes, Christmas was never a day.
No.
It was a season.
Yeah.
It was a time to feel full, to be with friends, to have light and sound and gaiety, as they would have it. And actually, that really comes in on Boxing Day. So again, I think I might try and redesign my own Christmas for next year. I'm kind of hoping someone invites me for Christmas next year.
That would be nice. I was going to say maybe I'll invite you for Christmas this year.
But, do it.
Yeah.
Nobody, I think there's because my life revolves around food.
Mm. I find this the same, and I wonder if any of our listeners have it too. Like, if you are a professional or a food person, whether in a professional or just, you know, you love cooking and eating.
Mm.
People don't want to cook for you.
No.
They're scared to, which I hate, because I will literally eat anything, and if someone's made it for me, I will love it.
I wrote piece. It was one of the first things I wrote, and it was about my own gran. Long story short, I cooked her last Christmas dinner before she passed away.
Wow.
And my impression of the day had been that it was a disaster, because Everything was overcooked or undercooked.
Mm-hmm.
I was like 3 hours late on getting it to the table. My family were sitting in my living room for 3 hours, hungry.
Oh, no.
And like, it was just that way that everything goes wrong.
Yeah.
And you think, it's such a failure.
Mm.
In processing what had happened, I realised that it was because I was trying to get, you give the love you want.
Yes.
And I actually want people to take care of me.
Mm,
and that way that I like trying to take care of other people.
Yeah.
But when you become proficient at giving the love you need, people don't give you that love
anymore.
People
don't give it back. Yeah, that's a really interesting observation.
And then when my gran had passed away, at her funeral, everyone was talking about her food and about her scones and her shortbread and all this. And she was a prolific baker, but I was getting quite kind of upset or kind of indignant in that very young way that you do, where I was thinking, this is my gran, this isn't the woman who made you shortbread.
Yeah.
You didn't really know her.
Yeah.
And then my the minister got up and spoke about his last meeting with her. She was kind of ready to go home, in her words.
Okay, yeah.
Kind of religious woman. But the reason she was ready to go home is because she couldn't enjoy food anymore.
Mm.
And the last time she had enjoyed food was Christmas Day. She passed away in August.
Gosh,
the last time she'd remembered eating a full meal was...
Christmas,
when I had cooked for her.
Wow.
And that, for me, in the months kind of leading on from it, made me realise that she also had become proficient in cooking for people and taking care of people, and people didn't then do that for her.
Yeah.
The last big meal she remembers was someone cooking for her.
That's amazing. I mean, I think especially as you get older, if you are in these caretaking roles, like I'm the exact same. I think my love language is cooking for people. It's how I show my friends I love them. It's how I show my family I love them. And there sometimes it results in quite a funny when I'm at home, because my mum is an incredible cook. So is my dad, but my mum was always the sort of main cook of our family. It'll be like, I'll make dinner. No, I'll make dinner. No, I'll make dinner. No, I'll make dinner. But no, I think, yeah, that's so important to be able to show it. And
yeah. We should find a way to bring this conversation back to Hogmanay.
Back to Hogmanay. So.
So probably what we should explain first of all, coming back to the episode, what is Hogmanay?
So Hogmanay is a very Scottish tradition, and it is the celebration of New Year's Eve. But it's interesting that the actual sort of celebration of Hogmanay, the things we do on Hogmanay and have done traditionally in Scottish history, do sort of take from those earlier, potentially Icelandic, Druidic, Viking traditions and those earlier Scottish quarter days.
So what do you mean when you're talking about Icelandic influences?
So this is something I read, so I'm not going to go, I'm not going to go to the mat on this one.
It has been said.
But no, I was reading a Victorian article about Scottish Hogmanay traditions, and they were talking about the fact that it potentially has Druid or Icelandic origins. So the article reads, "It is argued that the word is traceable to Hogmanat, which is the Icelandic name of Christmas Day, signifying the time of slaughter and for circumstances." I don't really know what slaughter for circumstances is, but it sounds pretty gnarly.
It's like slaughtering with intention.
Rather than just mindless killing. But mindless slaughter. Slaughtering to mark the day.
To mark the day.
But it continues, and undoubtedly certain familiar Scottish customs of the time seem to have originated amongst the fierce worshippers of Thor and Odin. So we're basically being called out for being Viking slaughterers.
I mean,
where's the lie?
Where's the lie? if the blood soaked axe fits.
Exactly.
But I had another interpretation which is out there, and perhaps not from the traditions that I think could definitely be Icelandic or Norse or tied into that kind of Druid history.
Yeah.
But the word itself also might be French.
Mm.
At the same time, we have Hogmanay coming up as a word, as an event in the calendar, is when Mary, Queen of Scots, returns from France.
That would make sense.
After she has been exiled. And there's a word. I'm going to try and pronounce it.
Zut alors.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to do a French accent. when I was explaining, it is a word that you say, how you say. Sorry, to all of our French listeners.
We are sorry.
I think we have 3 French listeners, it tells me on the app.
Oh, love it.
People that listen. Anyway, it's spelled H-O-G-I-N-A-N-E. In my Scottish accent, that would be Hogginanny.
I kind of like
that.
In
a French accent, it might be Hogginan. Hogginan.
Love it.
But it means Galladay.
Galladay. Okay.
So it also...
That makes sense.
It might... I think what we're talking about here is centuries-old words.
Yes.
That have come to represent a day, the last day of the year in Scotland.
Yeah.
And we know that it's important... You were talking about the influence of the other quarter days.
Mm.
So if you haven't listened to the first 3 episodes, there are 4 quarter days throughout the year, spanning from Beltane and Imbolc and Lunasa Samhain.
Samhain,
that becomes Halloween. And those days are a millennium old.
Mm.
They have been kind of observed by hunters, gatherers, farmers. They tell us when the seasons are changing, when to take out the cattle, when to bring them back in, when to go out hunting, when to come back in. And when we have Yule that comes from the Vikings, we start to see some of that Celtic culture, Gaelic culture, that begins to infuse, and that we start to take some of the superstitions and some of the practices from those other quarter days, and we add them on to Yule.
Yeah.
And then when Yule is banned in Scotland in 1640, all of those superstitions and those traditions are then transposed onto Hogmanay. It's a relatively new holiday.
It's a great solution to, like, oh, we can't celebrate Christmas, just bump it down a few days.
Yeah. Isn't it literally like 6 days
later? Like a week, not even a week.
Yeah, you're banned from having Christmas parties. Well, this isn't a Christmas party. It's a Hogmanay party. This isn't Christmas bread. This is Hogmanay bread.
Well, it's interesting that the similarities between foods, as we'll go on to talk about, are quite, some of them are just the same oat cake with a different name.
I mean, but that is essentially what's happening here, is people need a midwinter festival.
Yes.
They need something to eat. We talked about, I believe, in episode 1. If you were a farmer or you were a hunter, you're not going out in December.
No.
Frost has taken over the fields. There's very little for you to do. You might be, you know, if you've got cows or you've got livestock that haven't been sent off to slaughter, you might be looking after them, but you're relatively kind of sparse working time.
Mm.
You're a lot of time spent inside with your family, with your neighbours.
Yeah.
And it's such a dark time.
Yeah, it's a survival period rather than a thriving period.
Exactly. And so when you take away Christmas, people are then looking for the next.
Mm.
If the exact same thing happened today and they got rid of Christmas and Hogmanay, we would find something else.
Yeah, it would be Twelfth Night. I mean, it is dreek enough getting through December and then knowing that the 31 days of January are lying ahead of you without the joy of a Christmas tree in your house?
Nah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So tell me about your Hogmanays growing up in the Northeast.
So, as is very traditionally Scottish, I suppose, the way we typically celebrated Hogmanay was with a ceilidh.
Okay.
And the place I grew up was very rural. There was 2 things within walking distance that were like businesses. One was a pub.
Yeah.
And one, in fact, the second wasn't even a business. It was like the village hall.
Right.
So you're walking, I'll paint a picture
please
for you. You're walking.
I'll add in some ambient sound if it's required here.
Excellent. Cows. you're walking like down this road, and it was an A road, so it wasn't like super tiny country road, but in the dark, fields surrounded by cows, which you could hear shuffling, you couldn't see them, you had your torch, and sort of maybe about 200 yards, 300 yards away from my house was the village hall. So we would stoat along there in the dark with our torches and our like bags full of clinking bottles and, you know, things to celebrate with. And there would be a ceilidh in the hall, and it was such a good time.
Mm.
I absolutely love a ceilidh.
You have some different ceilidh dances up in the Northeast, don't you, though?
I think so. I mean, most of it is the kind of tradition. And for anyone who doesn't know, a ceilidh is basically a sort of gathering in Scotland where you do ceilidh dancing. Yeah. So you do group dancing. There's typically a ceilidh band, which is traditional Scottish music. And I'm going to do a wee shout out to Clack and Yell, who were the best ceilidh band up in the northeast, who did our New Year's ceilidhs.
I will give a shout out to Scotia ceilidh band.
Excellent.
the best ceilidh band in the Central Belt.
Excellent. So you would come together and you would do these dances, have a few drinks and ring in the bells that way. But it's very much a part of Scottish tradition, because when we're in school, you have to do what is called, somewhat strangely, social dancing as opposed to antisocial dancing.
I think it was always called social dancing. It was also sometimes called country dancing.
Country dancing. Oh, that's interesting. See, in the country, it was just
dancing.
It was
dancing. Called
dancing. But yeah, so we literally had to do this at school. Oh. And I loved it. But for the first few years, when you're in primary school and maybe into like S3, when you hated boys, like you were terrified of the opposite sex.
Yeah.
I was
terrified of everyone.
You're just quivering in a corner. Yeah. But you didn't want to touch people.
No.
I remember like rolling down the sleeves of my jumper so that I didn't have to hold boys' hands.
Do you know what is absolutely terrible, right? And this should be studied as like collective trauma, right? Is that after you do a dashing white sergeant, which is a ceilidh dance.
Yeah.
Or a gay gardens for 15 minutes, you start sweating.
Yes,
you do. It is a warm... You've got 200 people in a small school hall dancing at top speed. And then you want them to then dance for another 5 minutes and hold hands and be in close proximity as well.
Heavens above, put your hand on a girl's waist.
Yeah.
Oh. So what about you? Were you ceilidhing in the New Year's in Paisley or...?
No, I mean, I grew up in a very, I would say, kind of religious family. Mm. Had a quite tight-knit, making it sound like a cult.
One of us.
But we had a like watch night service at the church. And then everyone would go back to my granny's house. Mm-hmm. So you would see in the bells. I don't think it's being overly generous to say there may have been like 70-odd people.
Wow.
That came back to my gran's house.
Gosh.
And my gran's house was a 1950s mid-terrace, like three tiny bedrooms.
Yeah.
And so it was like young people would sit on the stairs.
Love that.
And the senior citizens, the most senior were given...
Get an actual seat.
Sofas. Yeah. And then the parents, the people in their 40s had the dining room chair. And like your years as you went on, you were demoted to like the doormat.
A cushion on a floor.
Yeah. Literally babies were just lying on bare stone flooring. Aunt, she used to serve her ginger wine.
Ooh, that sounds delicious.
Well.
Ooh, something beautiful looking is being pulled out of a bag.
I have just... it's a very simple recipe, which is a bottle of Ulaid essence you get from the co-op.
Ulaid essence?
Ulaid.
Wow, I've never heard of Ulaid.
It's...
for when your Christmas isn't going well, you need some Ulaid.
Have a taste.
It smells lovely. Ooh, yum.
Sugar.
Mmm.
And this is diluted.
Yeah.
And it was fiery ginger.
Yum.
And this was, because obviously they were teetotalers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but this was what they would have to have in the new year. And she'd make a big batch and everyone would.
It's so much nicer than just having like a fizzy juice or something. Like it gives it an air of being special.
But I think she was born, when was she born? The 1920s, early 1930s.
Yeah.
So she lived during a time where ginger cordial was still like a homeopathic remedy for colds, for fevers.
Mm.
If you think about growing up in the west coast of Scotland in the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah.
Being able to keep yourself well when you're impoverished is a really important kind of factor of life. And... as her mum and her gran would have made, actually, winter wasn't just a Hogmanay thing.
Mm.
Ginger wine wasn't just a Hogmanay thing. It was something you had all winter long.
All winter to keep you going.
I suppose, like with my granny's ginger wine, or like your annual ceilidh fest, it's part of a longer story of Hogmanay in Scotland. And that's what we're going to look into next. Obviously, we talked about quarter days.
Yes.
And about how traditions and things had been lent to Hogmanay.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of the first thing that you would start to do for Hogmanay is to prepare your home for the day itself and for the change of year.
Yeah.
So what are the, some of the preparations that people would engage in?
So I think it very much depends on where you were living, what mm-hmm. kind of abode you had, whether you were in the city or the country. And one thing that I think remains today is the idea of like making sure your home is clean, making sure that you're entering the new year without clutter, without dirt around. Like my mum certainly still tidies the house before the new year. And that is very much linked to the older traditions of Hogmanay as well. So things like cleaning or saining,
mm-hmm.
which you would do by, I mean, there were various methods. One of the ones I was reading about, which happened in rural Scotland, was you would burn a juniper bush
mm-hmm.
in your home. But before you did that, you had to basically stopper up every nook and cranny
mm-hmm.
of your dwelling, which if you're living on a croft, in a croft house or in a cottage, that wouldn't be easy.
No.
We're talking drafty places.
Yeah.
So the idea of, you know, stuffing every little gap. And then what it would typically be the man of the family would do is he would take a juniper bush, take it inside and burn it. And the idea was you were filling your home with smoke, this fragrant smoke from a juniper bush, in order to sort of cleanse it and get rid of any potential evil spirits. And you would do this not just in your house, but also if you had outbuildings, say you were in the countryside, you had outbuildings for your animals, you would do it in there too. Mm. So your poor sleepy cold sheep or cows are then being fugged with this juniper bush. Like, what is going on? But the idea was you wanted to cleanse the energy basically so that they would be healthy, your family would be healthy, your household would be prosperous.
And I suppose we're not strangers to this.
No.
Because lots of people will sage
their house. Yes, you smudge your house with sage. I burn incense sometimes if I want to just make sure there's a good vibe.
I just try and clean the cobwebs. That's as much as saning as I get into these days.
Fair enough.
But it is about that, the link between the changing of the season and a spiritual practice.
Mm.
Like, I think when we talk about superstitions or the way that people used to live, to some people it can sound quite witchy.
Yes.
But I think you have to think about it in the same way you might think about star signs.
Mm-hmm.
Or the way you might not walk over cracks in the pavement or walk under a ladder.
You might salute a magpie. Do you not salute magpies?
I do not salute magpies.
You do not salute magpies. Do you say hello to them?
No.
Oh,
that
Peter.
Must be a northeast thing, sorry.
I think that's just a general thing. You're cursed. Do you know the magpie rhyme?
One for sorrow, two for joy, three for a
girl,
four for a boy, five for
silver,
six
for gold, and seven for a secret never to be told.
And so eight means you need to clean up because you've got an infestation. Magpies.
Call the exterminators. No, so if you see one magpie, it's meant to be bad luck because it's one for sorrow. So you always have to say, I just give them a wee wave, or you salute them. Or if you're really dedicated to the cause, so you don't jinx yourself, you say, hello, Mr. Magpie, say hello, say good day to your wife. Because then it implies there are two magpies, which is two for joy.
How much time does this take up in your daily life?
I mean, there's a lot of magpies around
here.
Like, I'm like just going around waving all the time.
I'm not going to start this because if I start this, feel like I'm going to sign over years of my life to chatting to magpies. It's not done me any harm thus far.
Excellent. Well, that's all we need to make sure the household spirits
don't. Do you know
why
you say knock on wood?
No. Why do you say knock on wood?
It comes from a time when people believed that malevolent spirits lived inside of wood, lived inside of objects.
Ah.
And you would knock on wood so they couldn't hear your good intentions and try to foil them.
Try to jinx you. Ah, that's interesting. Knock on wood.
Anyway, moving on.
So yes, we have these sort of, these almost pagan, you know, kind of witchy traditions, as you say, that sort of seem to bleed to Hogmanay from the other quarter days. And that's really because I think this time of celebrating the turning of the year it wasn't just about the rebirth of a new year. It was about a time where the veil, perhaps, between our world and other worlds grew thinner. Mm-hmm. So those superstitions would be more prevalent than they might be in other times of the calendar year. So a lot of Hogmanay traditions do revolve around that kind of like divination and preparation and trying to make sure you're going into this new year in as good a position as you could be.
Yeah. So divination, for people who are not familiar with this term, divination is essentially fortune telling. Mm-hmm. You are having an action, you are breaking an egg, you are looking into the wind, you are casting something on the ground and you're looking for it to tell you something. Think about like reading tea leaves as a really great example. I think most
people
can be
aware of. Yes, or tarot cards or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're looking for indications of what the year to come is going to give you. So mm-hmm. what are some of the examples of divination?
So interesting ones that I have found in a Scottish context seem to revolve either around the weather or your love life. So different things, different priorities for different people.
Of course.
But with the weather.
What are you interested in, Lindsay?
I'm interested in the weather. No, yeah. I will start with the weather one, but then, yes. With the weather, apparently the direction of the wind on Hogmanay would tell you how the climate was going to be for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
So apparently if the wind was coming from the north, it portended cold and storms, I presume because the north is where the cold is. If it comes from the east, there would be an abundance of fruit on the trees, which sounds like quite a nice wind.
But I don't understand. Is that a thing?
Geographically, I don't know. Would a wind from the east be warmer? Not really.
We need a meteorologist.
At
head of the weather.
A south wind makes sense because it would be heat and plenty. So wind from the south would always be a bit warmer. But a west wind apparently means an abundance of fish and milk.
Again, where is this coming from?
I think north and south makes sense, but yeah.
But one of the other interesting things, and I think it's regional specific, and it's actually in the northeast, is another word for Hogmanay and the day itself is Cake Day.
Cake Day?
Yeah, so I've got a wee news article here.
Oh, excellent.
That came from the Edinburgh Evening News, and it talks about the old Hogmanay custom of Cake Day was celebrated in St Andrews today. From an early hour, children went round shopkeepers and householders for whom they received gifts of shortbread, currant buns, etc., repeating the old rhyme, "My feet's cod, my shoon's thin, gie's my cakes and let me rin." Kilsyth inhabitants were awoken early this morning when drummers and pipers marched through the town, keeping up the ancient custom of warning them of Advent and the last day of the year. During the day, the old people attended the town hall to receive parcels of tea and sugar.
Oh, that's lovely.
I love that.
Yeah.
But again,
Cake Day.
We see things about Cake Day coming through, and lots of it is in the northeast, or at least in around the north.
Yeah.
And it's really bakeries.
Yes.
And housewives as well, I'm assuming, were the prolific bakers of their community.
Yeah.
That are giving out shortbread as a mainstay, and also currant buns and currant men.
Currant men?
Which I think are... If anyone has a clarification, please do get in touch. hello@tenementkitchen.com. But like gingerbread men.
Yes.
But filled with currants.
But filled with currants. Yum, that sounds delicious.
I did bring with me today a family recipe, a currant bun. I need to put down my mic very briefly.
I don't know if you can hear, but currently, didn't even mean to do that. Peter is unwrapping a beautiful looking sort of fruit cake. Oh, it looks excellent.
Now, this is a currant loaf, but I found this in my mum's mum's recipe book under the name ? Loaf.
Oh.
And not when I say question mark, I mean a little question mark sign.
Not like you just couldn't read it.
No. ? It's add all the ingredients into a pot and then boil.
Thank you.
And then you add flour into those ingredients.
I'm just going to take a bite of this currant bun.
On mic.
On mic, yeah. You can all listen to me chewing. No, I'm joking.
My gran's sister is still alive up in the Highlands. And I went up to Dorney and I took her, my gran's, her sister's cookbook that she had never seen before, showed her it. And then we went through all the recipes and she talked about what ones she remembered. And we got to question mark loaf. And she said, oh, question mark loaf. That was from when your granddad lost his job.
Oh.
And he was unemployed for months.
Oh, gosh.
And when he got a new job in a factory driving a forklift.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so nervous about going in that Belle took whatever ingredients she had, my grand Belle, and just flung it together because he didn't have much left. There was no self-raising flour left. There was no rising agents left. She had plain flour. She had currants. She had butter.
Mm.
And so she just threw it all together and created this fruit loaf, but didn't know what to call it. So she put it in her book as
question mark loaf. That's so lovely. I mean, not like the most lovely reasons for that story to have to happen, but the fact that it was sort of part of the family lore, and also really good cake for just a
throw together
mix up. Yeah.
But this is a far cry from a black bun.
No.
Which is the other big Hogmanay dish.
Yes.
So we actually, we talked about black bun like 3 months ago.
We did. That was kind of the starting point for me of the Christmas food bonanza.
And it came out like last week.
Yes.
So for those of you who are not aware of Sam Bilton, she has a podcast called Comfortably Hungry.
Yes.
And we did an episode all about black bun. But why don't you tell the people about black bun while I have another slice of question mark loaf?
Yeah, because I absolutely wolfed mine down. It's so good. So black bun is very different from this kind of pale, buttery currant loaf in that it is very dark. It's a dark sort of fruit cake. And as the name suggests, it is a sort of rich fruit cake with a dark colour. But the interesting thing about black bun is that it's wrapped in pastry.
Mm.
So it's like fruit cake on croute. And it's a very traditional Hogmanay food in that, and it would be full of currants, full of these, you know, spices if you had them, wrapped in pastry. I mean, a fruit cake is a fairly solid thing in itself.
Mm-hmm.
They're cooked to last.
Yeah.
But by encasing it in pastry, you're making it even hardier.
Well, I think the story, because when we talked a lot about this, about black bun, I think black bun is another one of those things that belongs to bakeries.
Yes.
Because although we do have recipes that begin to come through in 1826, it's also called a Scotch bun.
Okay, interesting.
And it is included in some early recipe books. But the year before, it had been in an advertisement in London from a bakery talking about how it was a joyous cake that had been on the table of King James, and it was a great Scottish festive fare. That's a lot of marketing.
Yes.
And people saying, you should get this because this is part of a Scottish Hogmanay.
Mm.
But at the time, you had made the point that most people don't have an oven.
No.
And you really need, for cooking a fruit cake,
yes,
you tend to need high intense heat.
So unlike a pudding, which you could boil, so your Christmas pudding, you would be wrapping it in a cloth and boiling, as we discussed previously. You're right, you would need to put this in an oven. And you couldn't, the other things that you might have, so carles were one thing that, if we return to guising, boys would apparently get from each house, and they're like flat oat cake, again, another kind of bannock, I think. And apparently often collected with a slice of cheese, which sounds nice. But those oat cakes, those bannocks, they can be cooked on a griddle on fire. So you don't need an enclosed oven. To cook a big pie like this, what is essentially a pie, a fruit cake, you need an oven. And unless you were wealthy in the countryside, or even wealthy with, you know, the space to have an enclosed range, up until, I mean, you sort of get more enclosed ranges creeping in around sort of early 1800s, like 1820s, 30s, but it's very much only for people who can afford them. So instead, what you would do, if you had something like this that you needed to cook, you would take it to a baker's where there was a communal oven and they would bake it for you. Or you would just buy it from the bakers themselves.
Hmm. And I think that's much more likely.
Yes, I agree.
Because I think sometimes when we see things in recipe books, we cannot make the assumptions that it was being made in the home.
No, and particularly early cookbooks and manuscript recipe collections, because they might have been cooked in the home of the Lady of Sutherland,
yeah,
but they weren't be cooked in anyone's home.
Yeah. When we are looking at the correlation between shortbread and Hogmanay, we can see that it's part of the cake day. We can see it's something that's baked at the time. But this idea of it being something which is part of Hogmanay, part of this festive season, I think a lot of this is to do with marketing as well.
Mm.
We see in the Victorian era that shortbread tins begin to be plastered with tartan and castles and deer. I remember talking to Macon about the history of whiskey in the last episode.
Yes.
And she was talking about this kind of new approach to selling Scotland as part of the empire and to be sent out to the colonies.
Mm.
I think things like shortbread tins and our black bun really belongs to bakers.
Yes.
There's a great example of how they've influenced our ideas of nationality.
Exactly, and made it the literal cookie cutter tartan tin, you know, image that people in London want to buy. So I bet you could probably buy like a festive hamper in Fortnum and Mason, which would have a black bun some shortbread, some whiskey,
maybe some ginger wine. No, that's for poor people, never mind.
Yeah, we'll stick with the whiskey.
Whiskey.
But you would maybe buy your hamper that was full of your Scottish Hogmanay experience to have as part of your celebrations.
We should start that should be our merch for next year.
Yes. Hampers. I love
Scottish Rotisserie Podcast hampers.
They would be great.
It would be amazing. What would we have? We'd have whiskey,
ginger wine, currant cake of some kind.
A gin.
I feel like you could do some really nice, like, smoked fish.
Yes, juniper smoked fish.
Yes. Oh, some good cheese. Some good Scottish cheese.
A Yule kebbock,
indeed. You could have some nice venison of some kind. Venison salami.
Yes, maybe. Yep. In the mode of like a reasted mutton.
Yes.
Where it's kind of slightly smoked.
Yes.
Right.
Getting hungry now.
Dragons. I'm asking for £100,000 for 5% collateral. But everything we're talking about here is getting us ready for the bells.
The big moment.
Now, I had a question that occurred to me and I went down a bit of a rabbit hole.
Love a rabbit hole.
How would people know the time?
That is a very good point.
Because Hogmanay, unlike the other quarter days, where the festivities begin when the sun goes down, there's a marker in the sky that you're looking for that tells you it's time to start.
Yeah.
And it's also not, it's approximate.
Yeah, exactly.
There might be some light out, you know, it starts...
It changes depending on how far north you are, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. But Hogmanay is fixed around a countdown to New Year.
Mm.
So I first started to look into the history of clockmaking in Scotland.
Wow.
As part of this. So, the first records tell us the first town clock was in 1462, and that was in Peebles.
Oh, excellent. I have a friend that lives in Peebles.
If they were there in 1462, they would have known the time.
Well, excellent.
And it was blacksmith, but we didn't really have the discipline of clockmakers yet. We had blacksmiths that understood the mechanics and then created. And then it was mostly by, like, something began to, churches or benefactors or town halls began to get built and they would put on a clock. It was a sign of a real kind of up-and-coming town or community that would have a clock.
Look at us, we're punctual.
The big thing that changes in the Victorian era, clocks are getting more and more common, but people aren't really prescribing to living their life by the clock.
Interesting.
Until we have the National Rail Service.
Ah, it's always the trains. It's always the technology that you don't expect.
And suddenly, it's more important than ever if you're going to be someone that's doing business, if you want your town to flourish, you have to have a clock so that people know when to leave for the train.
Yes.
In the 15th and 16th century, when we're seeing churches beginning to get clocks and we're seeing town halls begin to get clocks, people are gathering around them.
Yes.
So when we're about to come on to talking about what happens after the bells and first fitting.
So what is first fitting?
First fitting is an idea where the first person that crosses the threshold to your house going back to divination, is going to tell you, or is going to bring favour into your home, is going to bring blessings into your home. So there is a notion that your first footer should be a man with a dark complexion who brings whiskey and coal. Tall.
Yeah. Preferably devastatingly handsome.
Yeah, sonsy, as you might say. But actually, historically, there's regional differences as to what makes you lucky or unlucky.
Yeah, the perfect first footer.
And some, and we talk a lot about men, but actually women were just as, were maybe a second rung below. If it wasn't going
classic.
To be, if it wasn't going to be a handsome 7 foot sonsy bloke,
yeah,
then actually a fair face hen walking through the door would be just as lucky.
Yeah.
But actually across Scotland, we see different regional things cropping up.
Say you were going to be first footing.
Yeah.
You might have a black bun with you as a gift. The idea was that you would enter someone's home. And am I right in thinking it could be your own home, but it could also be the home of others?
I think if you were first footing, you weren't really first footing your own home.
No.
You were bringing, you were taking your luck to someone else.
Okay, so you're, it's that act again of hospitality, of spreading what people have at this time of year.
Yeah.
So you, you wanted to be armed with whiskey.
Yeah.
A black bun or equivalent kind of cake, something to eat, something to drink, and that would indicate that the people who you have first footed will have a prosperous year.
Yeah. And it's very practical things as well. If you are opening your home and you live in a crofting community or you live in a small village, you might have 40 people that come through your door after midnight, keeping the room warm. But we hear that bringing whiskey to the party was a big kind of a plus point for the new year. The creation of whiskey was a woman's work.
Yeah.
And you had to distill and bottle enough in your daily life to save up for the next big community event. So if your daughter was getting married, you would have to make enough whiskey that everyone in your community who came to the wedding could drink for the entire night. And if the bottles ever ran out, it was a source of immense shame.
Yes.
So I think we can definitely transpose that to Hogmanay.
Yeah.
When they're kind of 16th century, when we're seeing people beginning to celebrate Hogmanay and doing first footing. Women are definitely just distilling whiskey. And so bringing a bottle of whiskey really takes the load off. You're saying, I am a zero consequence guest.
Yes.
I will contribute more than I'm taking away from you.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we see kind of good luck. People saying, you didn't bring anything.
Yeah.
I think it's bad luck.
Yeah.
I think that's really, really where it stems from. The other thing that you might bring with you is Athol Brose.
Ooh, tell me about Athol Brose.
I'm not just going to tell you.
No.
I made Athol Brose.
Oh, wow.
Now, this isn't a Florence Mary McNew recipe. This is a roving haggis recipe.
Excellent.
Our modern daily equivalent
of
Florence Mary McNew. Do we want ice with this?
Do we want ice? Could do. Shall I go grab some ice? And go grab some ice while Peter pours the brose.
So, Athol Brose is essentially, if you think like a kind of oat milk, but it's oats that are steeped in milk and then whiskey is added. And you could definitely add like sugar or flavourings or whatever you wanted to add. But at its core, it's a oaty milk whiskey drink. I have never really been a Baileys drinker. Are you a Baileys drinker?
I can have a Baileys, but it's not really...
Well, I want you to tell me if this is akin to a Baileys.
Akin to a Baileys, okay.
Because the idea of a milky whiskey isn't necessarily very appealing to me.
No, but then a sort of creamy liqueur.
Perhaps, but again, to make this, you steep oats. I steeped pinhead oatmeal, toasted pinhead oatmeal in milk. You could also do it in cream, I think, if you're being luxurious.
Bougie bros.
Bougie. And what else is Yule for? What else is the festive season for, if not for luxuriating in...
Cheers.
Oh, cheers.
Oh, it smells really nice. Ooh. Mm. You know, you can really taste the oats.
You can.
The, like, toastiness of them coming through is lovely.
There's quite a bit of whiskey in there, but you're not really... No. It's not hitting.
I actually really like that. It's not too sweet at all.
No.
It's quite... It quite often comes up in Scottish literature. So I'm sure Robert Louis Stevenson mentions Athelbrose at some point. And it gets mentioned as well in a lot of the travel writing that the Romantic authors did around visiting Scotland, their tours.
Right, their Athelbrose. So it's nicer than I thought it was going to be.
It is. It's very drinkable, actually.
It is.
I mean, I'm always somewhat wary of dairy and booze. Like, I'm not a massive White Russian drinker or...
Oh, you know what? That's what I'm thinking of.
A White Russian.
I'm thinking of a White Russian.
It is. It's more like a White Russian than it is like a Bailey's, because it's sort of thin and not too sweet. But actually, I do, yeah. I'm a Brose fan.
Cheers to Athelbrose.
Cheers to Athelbrose.
Thank you very much, Roving Haggis.
Love it. So speaking of cream, kind of, we're speaking of creamy things and Athelbrose. On a historical Hogmanay, I would not be going first fitting. And I will not be going first fitting this year. Instead, I'm after the cream of the well.
Right.
Yes.
Tell me about the cream of the well.
Unlike this delicious Athelbrose, it is not a drink. It is the idea that it's the first draft of water from the well that's drawn up after midnight. So back in towns or rural dwellings, when you would have water wells, you would pull up the bucket, you would be racing to the well, you'd pull up the bucket and you'd want that sort of first sip of the water of the new year. And this is back to divination. Because apparently, if you get the cream of the well, it doesn't only ensure good luck for the year, but it ensures the certainty of a husband.
Certainty of a
the
husband.
The certainty of a husband. That's a potent potion.
Where is the nearest well to Maryhill?
I could be up in the canal, but then I think I might probably get dysentery.
Well, maybe you'll find a husband.
Maybe I'll find a husband. Worth it.
There's another ritual that was said to guarantee a husband. No, you can't do this by yourself.
Okay.
I'm afraid.
I'm going to need pals.
You're going to need pals for this, and you need to have no knowledge of it happening.
Oh, well, that makes it a bit harder.
You also need a stone that weighs a couple of hundred pounds.
Okay. I mean, I've got a good collection of stones. I don't think then...
I don't know if Jusons can deliver.
Yeah.
On New Year's
Day. JCB.
Yeah. But essentially, there is in Aberdeenshire, in Fordyce.
Okay, yeah.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Fordyce?
Yeah.
Fordyce?
Fordyce? No, it's Fordyce,
that yeah. Athelbrose has gone straight to my head.
Two sips and he's away.
I'm away. It was a several hundred pound stone, and it would be rolled to the door of a fair maiden. And it was supposed to almost guarantee a husband in the year ahead.
Is that because you've just got a massive rock sitting outside, so it's like a big indicator, like, person who wants a husband lives here?
Well, it was the young men of the town would roll it towards Miss Congeniality.
Ah,
imagine. Who's the most desirable, the most fetching lady. So I'm going to read out to you a newspaper article from 1944. Despite the war and the fact that the young men of the village are now scattered far and wide in the service of their country, one of the most ancient Hogmanay customs was still observed in Banffshire. Banffshire?
Banff. So it almost sounds more like a than a
Banff. Banffshire.
Yeah. Banff.
Banffshire was carried out at Fordyce last night, the shifting of the mortar stone. According to the legend, the stone, which weighs several hundred pounds and is hollow in the centre, is supposed to have a particular charm. If it is placed at the door of an unmarried woman on the first day of the year, she will be wedded before the year is out. In times gone by, the trialling of the stone around the village was taken part of by a number of leading men of the community, but in more recent years, it was done by the young villagers. Last night, just on the stroke of midnight, the custom was dutifully carried out by the younger loons in absence of their older brothers. Once it is deposited at the door of an unlikely maiden, it remains there until the next Hogmanay, when once more it goes on the rounds.
Wow, that's so lovely of them to keep it going.
To keep it going. But the Hogmanay is really for young people.
It is. And actually, speaking of things in the northeast that were changed by the war, one of these is the Stonehaven Fireball Festival.
Right, yeah.
So Stonehaven is a town on the northeast coast. Excellent fish and chips and ice cream. It's really...
Yeah. You'd expect.
And every year, to this day, they still... So starting sort of late 1800s, I think it was late 1800s, but starting in the 19th century, they had this fireball festival. And what it was, or what it is people... Traditionally, it was only people who lived in Stonehaven who could take part. And they would sort of make baskets, and they would fill these baskets with flammable material. It was quite a good way of getting rid of things that you didn't need anymore. So fishing town, we're talking fishing ropes, you know, bits of wood, scraps. But you wanted to create this ball in your basket, basically, that would burn long and brightly. And then they would parade down the streets, sort of twirling these balls around in this like amazing display of pyromania, which again probably dates back to the way that fire has been present in a lot of these festivals that we've been discussing. And the reason that it's come to mind is that one of the only 2 years since it began that it didn't happen was because of the war and because we were in blackout. So you couldn't have your fire festival because in case you got bombed, which is just mad.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the crescendo of the evening has to be singing Auld Lang Syne.
Yes.
It probably wouldn't be sung once.
No.
It would be sung at every house you went into and in the streets.
Yeah.
And probably louder and more off key as the night went on.
As the night wears on.
But oh, the lyrics were written in 1788 by Robert Burns.
Yep.
And we will be preparing for Burns Night.
We will
very
be.
Soon.
Burns season is quickly coming upon us.
But music was only set to it in 1799.
Ah, okay.
But it was really during the Victorian era.
Yes.
Because they were so obsessed with remembering people.
Yes.
And traditions. Mm-hmm. Inventing history.
Yep.
And leaning into customs.
Connections with the past. I think so much writing. And so much writing in Victorian cookbooks is all about how food ties us to different times in the past.
Mm.
And you're right, Auld Lang Syne is part of that. I've always thought it's quite a poignant song. But despite being quite a poignant song, it ends up being incredibly raucous. Certainly in my New Year's, because we were at Kaylee's.
Right.
So what we would do is you'd sort of finish the dances. It would be the last musical number of the night. Everyone would stand in a circle around the edge of the hall with their arms crossed in front of them, and you would hold the hand of the person next to you, or both people next to you in a big circle. And as the song kicks in, you would sort of run into the centre of the room, all holding hands, and then run out. But the tempo of Auld Lang Syne would be picked up. So you would start doing this really fast.
We do that
at weddings.
Yeah, but we don't do it with Auld Lang Syne.
No, what do you do?
You take the low road, I'll take that. You take the high, I'll take the low. Me and my daughter. What, Loch Lomond?
Yes.
So you had to sing the entire thing there to try and get to Loch Lomond. Do you not do that? You do Auld Lang Syne up north.
Yeah.
What?
I think.
Cultural differences.
I know. I'm going to have to check this, but it's definitely not Loch Lomond.
I think we're going to do an Instagram poll.
Instagram poll. And I'm sure at weddings and stuff, I've done it to Auld Lang Syne.
That's... A wedding in the Central Belt?
Potentially not.
Right.
I'm going to need to fact check myself. But but in my memory, it's always Auld Lang Syne. It's the final number of the night.
I'll be in Scotland. And then it gets quicker and quicker and quicker, and then you run into the centre.
Yeah, no, I'm sure we do it to Auld Lang Syne. Wow.
I'm going to have to investigate this now.
I'll be texting my mum imminently.
If you would like to weigh in on the poll, come to the Tenement Kitchen Instagram.
And vote for Auld Lang Syne, correct answer.
But maybe it will end this podcast with just finishing off the last descriptor of Hogmanay in Edinburgh. As the hands of the clock approach the Rubicon, a hush falls upon the waiting throng. The atmosphere grows tense. Then suddenly, a roar rises from a myriad of throats. The bells peal forth and the sirens scream. The new year is born. The shouting and the greetings over, The last strains of Auld Lang Syne have died away. The crowd disperses, and the young folk, after a raid of the orange barrels and sweetie shops, set off on their first footing expeditions.
Excellent.
Happy Hogmanay, Lindsay.
Happy Hogmanay, Peter.
Thank you for joining us on this mini-series. We'll be back on January 20th with our new series, still focused on the Victorians, but investigating some of the great Scots that revolutionised Scottish food. This episode of the Scottish Food History Podcast was hosted by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist. This podcast is produced by Tenement Kitchen. If you want to find out more about Scottish food, or if you have any questions about the episode, please get in touch at hello@tenementkitchen.com.